This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Nuclear warfare is a very unpleasant subject to talk about, which is why people don't generally talk about it. Even when, earlier this month, North Korea tested an intercontinental ballistic missile capable of reaching the United States. It was in the headlines for a couple of days, and we quickly moved on. But we're going to talk with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the details of this missile launch that show we shouldn't be so quick to dismiss what happened there. The dangers of nuclear warfare are very real, and it's important for us to keep our eyes wide open to them rather than sticking our heads in the sand the way so many people are doing. One important environmental cause is how to stop the spread of desertification. About a third of the Earth is desert today, and it's spreading at a rate of about 45,000 square miles per year. What causes deserts, and how do we stop them from spreading? The answer is actually quite inspiring. We're going to talk about this with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller. In our third segment, we'll talk some shop about changes to our website, thetrumpet.com. We're introducing a couple of new features that I believe will make the experience even more pleasurable for you, our readers. We'll talk with the Trumpet's designer, Steve Herkus, and our online marketing guru, David Vigil, about what we're trying to accomplish with these changes. And I'm going to finish the program off today by puncturing a couple of myths about love and talking about what love actually is. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. You're probably aware that back on July 4th, North Korea launched an intercontinental ballistic missile capable of reaching the United States. Now, there's so much happening in the world today that this kind of news easily gets overtaken by other headlines. But this is not the sort of news that we can afford to forget about. Trumpet writer Richard Palmer has an article up at thetrumpet.com about how even though the media seems to have pretty well moved on, nuclear experts are very concerned about what has happened here, what North Korea is actually capable of. I have him here to talk about this subject. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
So let's talk about some of the media narrative that has led people to be dismissive of what North Korea is actually capable of here. First of all, let's talk about this idea that, well, okay, they may have a missile, but they actually wouldn't be able to fit a nuclear warhead on that missile, so there's nothing to be concerned about here. Maybe you could just talk about the facts that might undermine that assumption.
Well, like all of these kind of myths that the media talk about, there is some truth there. It certainly is a lot harder to build a nuclear weapon that can sit on top of a rocket, that's small enough to sit on top of a rocket, that can fly thousands of miles through space at insane speeds, come back down again, and then explode. So, yeah, there is some truth to that. But when you look at what the experts are saying, generally they say, well, North Korea has the technology to make these missiles. It's absolutely ridiculous to think they don't have the technology to shrink their nuclear weapons. So one of these experts is Jeffrey Lewis. He's the director of the East Asian Non-Proliferation Program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California. It's a bit of a title. Odds are you've probably read quotes from him. He pops up in almost every article I've seen on North Korea, or at least a huge number of them. So he is one of the top experts in this field. And he says, I don't have any doubt that North Korea has a compact fission device that fits on a ballistic missile. And he talks about, for example, if you go back and look at what other nuclear powers were capable of at this stage in their nuclear program, when they'd conducted five tests like North Korea has, and he contrasts it with China and says, well, China, at the same point in its program, was able to do this. And he even makes the point that if you go back to China and you look at what people were saying while China was developing their nuclear weapons program, they were saying exactly the same thing, mm-hmm. that it was that we don't need to worry, they couldn't fit it on a missile. And they went and they made their fourth test in 1966. They did just that. They stuck a miniaturized nuclear weapon on a missile and quite literally exploded that myth. I mean, he
So the people who were making those claims at the time, we have the same people making the same claims in spite of the fact that they were proven wrong.
Exactly. And I mean, Lewis kind of talks about, well, maybe it's to do with we just don't believe that these kinds of powers that used to be fairly backwards can possibly catch up to this level of technology. But you know, this idea has been proven wrong before. And Lewis is not the only expert saying this. I mean, in my article, I quoted from the former CIA director, Ambassador R. James Woolsey, Dr. Peter Vince Pry. He's on the EMP, Electromagnetic Pulse Commission. He's the chief of staff of the Congressional EMP Commission. There's one of the CIA's top analysts for East Asia said the same thing. The director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Lieutenant General Ronald Burgess, he said the same thing. The former commander of the North American Aerospace Defense, NORAD. So, you know, this is the whole gamut of top experts in this field saying, look, well, actually, they can do this. And, you know, this one of the articles written by the former CIA director and as well as Dr. Peter Pry says the mainstream media and some officials who should know better continue to allege this. So it's something, there are a few experts, but for the most part, you look at what the experts overall are saying, and you know, this is something that you hear all the time in the media, and you hear much more rarely among people that actually know what they're talking about.
It's amazing how readily people will accept these ideas, despite past history showing that it's not the accurate picture of what's going on there. So another argument that's put forward is, well, okay, maybe they can launch this farther than they've been able to do in the past, but it can only reach Alaska. So it's only Alaska that's within. Apparently, it's not that important that it's only Alaska, and they're reassured by that fact. What's the reality as far as this goes?
The reality is that Alaska is the minimum proven distance, and actually, there is evidence that they can go further. So with this particular missile test, they kind of launched it at an unusual angle. They launched it so the missile went much higher than normal and then came down and therefore traveled along the Earth a relatively short distance. Mm-hmm. But you can measure and look at how far it went up and down. And so experts worked out that, okay, 4,000 miles and it could reach Alaska. However, you know, you can't kind of then just be nice and secure and say, well, they can't reach any further. For example, again, going back to the same Jeffrey Lewis, he talked about how him and some of his colleagues, he cites David Wright at the Union of Concerned Scientists, they were studying this flight, and they concluded that it looked like they cut the engines early on this flight. And that would be something relatively easy to do. And that actually this missile that they tested, its full range would take it much further. And they said they're still trying to work on calculations and exactly how far the range is, and they're not exactly sure how far the range is, but they're not at all confident that Alaska's the limit.
And another thing that Americans seem to be taking solace in is the idea that we have a missile defense capacity that would enable us to knock out any North Korean missiles, just shoot them out of the sky, the bullet hitting a bullet or those types of defense mechanisms. But you say that that's not necessarily something that we should be quite so reassured by.
That's right. I, to mix my metaphors, a bit of bullet shooting a bullet is a long shot at the best of times. It's an incredible technological feat that America can even achieve that sometimes. But to achieve that all the time is just, I think, asking an impossible engineering feat. But I think what's most concerning about this is on May 30th, the U.S. Missile Defense Agency held a test of this system. It's called the Ground-Based Mid-Course Defense System. There are a few other defense systems, but the GMD system is the only one that would be capable of intercepting an intercontinental ballistic missile. Different types focus on different missiles. So they tested the GMD defense. They called it a very realistic defense. They told Congress this is an exact replica of what we would see if North Korea shot an ICBM towards us. However, the Los Angeles Times conducted an investigation and they concluded that actually that's not the case and that the government fudged a whole load of things on this test to make it way easier for the defense system to intercept the kind of the fake North Korean missile. So
amazing. So they actually there was a certain amount of determination on the part of these government officials to stack the deck in their favor to make it look like this was more capable than it actually is.
That's right. So they held the test during daytime, the most favorable time for the defense system. They told the people on the running the defense system, okay, we're going to do the test between this time and this time. I don't think Kim Jong-un is going to be that polite. Then they even did things like sail a ship specifically in position because they knew where the missile was launching. They knew when, so they put a ship in position so they can catch it very soon after it launches, which makes a big difference when it comes to accurately predicting the trajectory it's going to take. Mm-hmm. This meant that the U.S. radar could, and then they picked a route where the U.S. radar could track it continually, something that's very, that's not going to happen. North Korea, if they actually launch such an attack, they're expected to launch decoys with it. So you have a certain number of nuclear weapons and then a whole load more non-nuclear weapons. And in this case, they made the decoys quite different from the actual target nuclear weapon, which is, of course, the opposite to the way decoys function. Mm. So that made it very easy for the system to pick out which were the decoys and which weren't. And then the missile traveled slower than a North Korean ICBM would travel to reach the United States. So a whole load of different factors stacked in their favor. And the Times kind of ran these past a few experts. One of the experts they quoted was a physicist and radar engineer, David K. Barton, who said that to claim that this is a realistic test of the ability to handle sophisticated threats is ridiculous. And you have to ask, well, why do they even feel the need to fudge the test in the first place? I think it shows that they didn't have confidence that their system could handle this, and that they felt that they had to fudge it in this way. And this isn't this fudge test isn't the only evidence that America would be foolish to trust this GMD with its survival when it comes to nuclear war. The National Academies panel, they chaired by Walt Slocombe, they did did an investigation into the GMD. And they concluded that the system, this is Jeffrey Lewis kind of paraphrasing their conclusions, intended to defend the U.S. against North Korean or Iranian ICBM needed to be completely redesigned with new interceptors, new radars, and new concept of operation. They suggested starting over almost at square one. So not really a ringing endorsement of America's missile defense system there.
So, I mean, it is easy to put your faith in a system like that. But if you're just looking at the facts and evaluating all of these factors that demonstrate that it's not worth putting that kind of level of trust in, it should give anyone pause about that aspect of why we do need to be concerned about what's going on in North Korea. The other argument is, well, North Korea probably isn't crazy enough to do this anyway, like to actually launch a nuclear war against the United States. You say, well, let's not be so confident about that.
Right. I think first, anytime you're saying, well, we're probably safe from nuclear weapons, I think you're in a bad position anyway. This is one of the main kind of schools of thought of international relations, is that that nations act in their rational self-interest, and that school of thought is called realism. It's one of the main schools of thought that we even look at in international relations class at Herbert W. Armstrong College. But even Hans Morgenthau, who was kind of one of the founders of this whole school of thought, said, "Well, yeah, that works as a general assumption and as a working assumption. We couldn't have you couldn't even have a theory of international relations if you didn't have some kind of assumption that nations are going to act rationally." But you can't bet that that is always the case. And he wrote in his book, "For history shows, if history shows us anything, that all nations have been governed at times by fools and knaves and even a combination of both. That was bad enough before nuclear weapons existed, but imagine a fool or a knave or a combination of both in possession of nuclear weapons and nuclear war becomes unavoidable." So it's not like we can just trust all nations to act rationally. History that has not been true throughout history. And I think betting on the sanity of North Korea, that's a pretty shaky foundation for your future. But then what you've also got to consider is the very strong ties between North Korea and Iran. And we're seeing more and more evidence of the ties between the two come out by the month. I think that there's a lot of long-standing evidence going back in the 80s and 90s of the two working together on their missiles programs. I think it's just about universally accepted now that a lot of some of Iran's significant missiles back in the 90s came almost directly from North Korea. And there's a lot of even recently, January 29th, Iran performed a missile test, and a lot of experts, and there have been anonymous experts being reported by people like Reuters and others, Fox News, saying that this was actually a test of a new North Korean-designed missile. So you've got a lot of evidence that they're working together on their missile program. There have also been kind of reports about Iranian observers at North Korean missile tests, reports that Iran has paid North Korea to attend those tests and to even conduct some of those tests, that they're working together on the nuclear program. Now, those reports, this is a kind of, you're talking about a very murky area. This is something that Iran would want to keep secret. So those reports aren't from kind of the same kind of gold standard of reliability as some of the other experts that we've quoted so far, because a lot of this is all kind of cloak and dagger.
But the idea essentially is that we're not necessarily banking on the sanity of the Kim Jong-un regime. It could be that they ship these missiles to Iran and we would be dealing with miniaturized nuclear warheads on the tip of an ICBM coming from Iran.
That's right. You're not looking at trusting the rationality of one crazy-looking regime, but two. And I mean, the big piece of circumstantial evidence that the two are working together is once the Iran deal kind of kicked in and Iran was forced to limit making uranium production in North Korea at just about exactly the same time exploded. And so the implication is North Korea enriching uranium for Iran? And there's a lot of question marks about that. And so, yeah, you've got Iran that I think is easily crazier than North Korea. You've got this nation that sponsors terrorists around the world, and so then you've got the prospect of them perhaps generating some plausible deniability in the same way that kind of Russia has done, and Russia has proven if you give America an excuse not to point the blame at the main power behind some kind of deniable partner, they won't do that. So you've got Iran could hand off this any nuclear weapon, right, from a full nuclear weapon to some kind of dirty bomb or other type of weapon, to any number of terrorist groups. Hezbollah is the most prominent, but there's a whole bunch of other terrorist groups they work to and have links with. And then you've got the fact that this is a regime where you've got a whole number of people at the top, a part of this 12er branch of Islam, that believes that if they start World War III and if they cause a nuclear war, they're hastening the return of the Mahdi, of their Messiah. They're bringing about their own religious belief. And you can see tons of examples throughout history where nations have acted irrationally because of religious belief. And so you've not just got to worry about North Korea now. You've got these whole other worries and bigger worries from Iran too.
Well, I think you've done a very capable job of terrorizing all of us with all of these facts. I mean, and the thing on top of it all, of course, is what we come back to repeatedly is how many biblical prophecies there are about nuclear war erupting. We know that there's just a whole lot in the Bible that shows that it is going to we are going to be up against a nuclear threat and nuclear bombs going off. And World War III is going to be far more deadly than World War II was. So we're tracking all of the developments of the proliferation of nuclear technology very carefully, because we know that it's going to be used at some point. And everything that you're talking about here, I think it just adds to that narrative very powerfully. We appreciate that very much. And the amazing thing on top of all of that is the fact that the press in the United States just seems so dead set against publicizing the reality about this, and just they're so eager to move on and not really address the full extent of the threat that we're facing. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer. He has an article on thetrumpet.com. The title of it is "America is Asleep to the Danger of North Korean Nukes." Go check it out at thetrumpet.com. Richard, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Environmentalism is a hot topic. It's a very politicized topic today. Lots of people using heated rhetoric about how if we don't change this or that immediately, if we don't reduce carbon emissions or curb population growth, we're going to be melting the ice caps. We're going to be facing environmental Armageddon. Well, there are actually some environmental concerns that are quite a bit more immediate. They're easier to recognize, and we can actually know the causes of some of these problems. One of them is the spreading of deserts. Deserts are a product of poorly managed land, and they're spreading because we're continuing to make the mistakes that caused them. There are actually some proposed and supposed solutions that are aimed at helping our planet that could actually cause deserts to spread even further. To talk about this, I have trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
So let's talk about deserts. How big of a problem are deserts today, and how quickly is the problem spreading?
Right. Well, already the planet, about one third of the land mass on planet Earth is desert, and another third is in climate zones that are vulnerable to becoming deserts if they're not properly managed. Yeah, so the United Nations has come out with some statistics. They're pretty credible statistics showing that roughly 45,000 square miles a year, about the same size as the state of Rhode Island, is lost to a process of desertification, or it's basically the climate becomes so arid that even though you were able to grow things there in the past, you can't actually grow food there anymore. And so that is just kind of chipping away, you think, on the global scale about the size of Rhode Island. But, I mean, year after year, it doesn't take too long before just vast areas that were once grasslands where you could raise cattle or grow food are turning to dust and sand.
Okay, so what is the problem? Why deserts and what causes them to spread this way?
Right. Well, most the scientific research going into this is, as you'd probably expect, revolving around the issue of global warming or carbon emissions and methane emissions into the air. They're saying that, okay, well, greenhouse gases from cattle burps or from car tailpipes or from fossil fuel factories are causing the climate to change and the earth to dry out, which is kind of a shocking conclusion because when you look at the history of the planet's climate change, we know there were times in the past when the planet was quite a bit warmer than it was now, and those times have actually been associated with smaller deserts. It's normally when the planet cools down that evaporation slows down and deserts spread. Huh. So it's really kind of counterintuitive to think that greenhouse gases would be causing deserts.
Well, that's kind of the bogeyman for a whole lot of problems.
Yeah, these days it does seem to be, like you said, yeah, the bogeyman for a whole lot of problems. But there is another issue, which we've got much better scientific proof showing that causing these deserts to spread, which is namely soil degradation. And we know that about two-thirds of the Earth's land area is in places where it doesn't rain regularly year-round. There's a rainy season and there's a dry season. And so the key to keeping those areas from turning into deserts is you have to be able to hold the water from the rains in the soil until the next rains come.
Mm-hmm.
And that's done by vegetation. If you get like a savanna or a grassland, the rainy season will come and the soil will get wet, but there's enough vegetation covering the ground and enough organic, decomposing organic matter in the soil to hold that water there until the rains come again.
Uh-huh.
But once the soil degrades, or more specifically, the organic matter of the soil gets below 1%, it can't support vegetation anymore.
And what would be like a healthy soil would have how much organic matter in it?
A really optimal soil would probably have like 10% organic matter in it.
Okay.
You can usually get down to around 3.5% without experiencing too much of a reduction in crop yield. But once you go below 3.5%, the soil's capacity to grow vegetation starts falling off dramatically. And like I said, once you get below that 1%, you are into desert territory, where the soil can't support that vegetation. So even if it rains during the rainy season, the water just drains right through the soil or evaporates right back out the way it came.
Yeah.
And it becomes dry in a matter of days.
Yeah, you can tell the difference between soil that would retain water and sand, which, I mean, even a landscaper, you know that you use sand in order to actually improve drainage and prevent puddling and that type of thing. It doesn't hold on to the water.
Right, and so in those temperate regions with a rainy season and a dry season, I mean, there are some people who are claiming that it's like, okay, well, it's changing in rain patterns that's making the land turn to sand, when the evidence actually kind of suggests it's the exact opposite. It's the fact that the land has degraded into sand by losing all this organic matter in the soil that allows the moisture to either run away or evaporate and changes the rain patterns.
Okay, so what causes the soil degradation?
Yeah, soil degradation is obviously in a really healthy ecosystem, you've got what you call a closed nutrient cycle. You've got organic matter in the soil, and then plants grow in that organic matter, and it pulls organic matter and minerals out of the soil. But then you'll have like a buffalo or a wildebeest or some sort of animal will eat that plant, and then the minerals are inside of him. And then when through the manure on there, it goes right back to the soil where it came from. And so you've got a closed loop. Now, what can cause the organic matter in the soil? There's two ways that can happen. Is one is if you've got like people with massive cattle herds that are overgrazing the soil, you can graze the ground till it's bare. And then once the ground's bare, just the sun, just from direct exposure to the sun, the organic matter can degrade away. But today, probably the more widespread problem is actually undergrazing, to where you get a place like the savannas of Africa, which used to have like millions of wildebeest and zebra and other animals, or even like the Great Plains here in the United States that had 60 million buffalo on them at one time. This land was really fertile because it's being fertilized by the manure of all these vast herds of grazing animals. But when you kill off those animals or drive them away and then just grow crops instead, especially like in America, you grow this corn crop and now your nutrient cycle, you have organic matter in the soil, which goes up into the corn plant, and then the corn's harvested and shipped to a city someplace hundreds of miles away where people eat it. And then, like I said, their feces is flushed into a sewage system someplace. And at the end of it, the nutrients end up long away from the soil where they began with.
Right.
And so that organic matter starts to decline. And eventually, once it gets to a certain point, like I said, usually around that 1% level, you start getting it where there's not actually enough vegetation to keep the water in the soil, and you start turning into like a desert region.
So for that closed loop to work, you've got to have animals involved in that who are eating the plants and then who are producing the manure that keeps that cycle moving. If you remove animals from that, then you end up with the kinds of problems that we see today. And what's interesting is that you have people who will say, well, it's too resource intensive to produce meat, to have beef, to have, you know, animal protein as part of our diet. If we're really going to be using the Earth's resources in a sustainable way, we need to go to a completely plant-based diet, right? There's those people that are out there arguing that.
That is a really common argument amongst pretty much anyone associated with the United Nations and most environmental scientists today. And actually, if you ever, any of our listeners are able to get your hands on it, a little harder to find, but I think it's online some places. But back in the 1970s, under Herbert W. Armstrong established the Ambassador College campus at Brickett Wood, where they did like an entire several volume series entitled Your Living Environment, where they actually addressed that exact same thing about these scientists. They're saying like, okay, well, if you eat a plant, you get the full calorie value from the plant. If you eat a cow who ate that plant, you get less than 50% of the calorie value. the other 50% of those calories are lost.
Right.
But you're like, well, where did you lose them? I mean, it's the law of physics that matter's not created or destroyed. It went someplace.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, well, where it went is it went in the form of that cow's manure straight back into the soil where it came from.
Uh-huh.
For that closed loop. So they're saying that you'll get these scientists that says like, well, if we converted the world to a vegetarian-based diet and just all ate the crops, then instead of we'd actually be able to have feed a much larger population than you would now. But because you're not giving hardly anything back to the soil, this works for a century at most before deserts are so widespread across the world that you can't feed yourself anyway because the planet doesn't grow, or at least 2/3 of the planet doesn't actually grow things.
Yeah. So you've written an article about this. We've published it in the September edition of the Trumpet magazine, the print version of the magazine. And you talk about an individual who actually began to use the principles that we're talking about here in order to rehabilitate soil that had degraded to pretty much unworkable conditions. Tell us about him.
Yeah, this is wildlife biologist Alan Savory, who he grew up in northern Rhodesia, called Zambia today, back in the 1950s. And he's founded the Savory Institute and the African Center for Holistic Management that works at reclaiming desert lands. Really fascinating character. He was involved with in the Park Service in northern Rhodesia in the 50s, and he was noticing that the land there was degrading to desert. And so just kind of regurgitating some of these environmental philosophies he'd learned at college, he figures like, oh, well, it must be being overgrazed. And so he'd actually recommended to the government of northern Rhodesia that they kill 40,000 elephants so that the rest of the elephants would have enough food to survive. And they had that conclusion confirmed and killed the elephants. And the problem got worse.
Huh.
And so he'd really done a lot of study to figure out how he messed up there and had come to the conclusion that he'd made the exact opposite call. It wasn't that the land was being overgrazed. It had been that so many elephants and other animals had already been killed in that region that the savanna was not getting the manure it needed to remain fertile. And so over the next several decades, he developed this holistic management plan that uses cattle in areas like the Western United States and Africa and other places to replace like the herds of buffalo and wildebeest and other things that are no longer there and start recycling the grasslands back into manure and rejuvenating the soils. And like I said, in this article in The Trumpet, we put a spotlight on this particular village in Zimbabwe, but there's many other examples of what his institute's done around the world where they've taken areas on the brink of becoming desert, actually start managing cattle herds in there and rotating them through the land and in a way that actually increases soil organic content and then brings them back to the type of productivity they would have had like 50, 100 years ago.
That's really, really remarkable what he's doing. What's interesting is, as cutting edge as it sounds, it actually points you back, and you talk about this in your article, to laws of agriculture found in the Old Testament. Maybe you could just give us a brief summary of why what the connection is here.
Yeah, because the Old Testament agriculture laws are just really fascinating in that fact that God's first command to mankind was to dress and keep the Garden of Eden. There's only really 7 verses in Leviticus 25 about this thing called the land Sabbath that gets in specifics how to do that. So compared to other Bible laws like how to raise your children or how to treat your family, or that have just chapters and chapters and chapters of explicit instruction, there's really just this one reference to how to take care of the land, which is Leviticus 25. It says 6 years you can sow your crops, but the 7th year will be a Sabbath for the land. You can't prune your vineyard, you can't sow your crops, and you can't actually even harvest anything more than you need for your own personal consumption. If you have a perennial like strawberries or something like that that grows of itself,
yeah,
you can go pick it for you and your family, but you can't plant anything. and you can't harvest anything for sale that year, which means all the grain you need, you have to store away for the first 6 years, and all the vegetables you need have to come from your own personal vegetable garden. And now originally you're thinking like, okay, well, what's the point of this kind of unorthodox law, this prohibition? But the one thing it doesn't prohibit for sale is cattle. And there's actually in Leviticus 25, it even says during the land Sabbath, all of the increase of the land will be in meat.
Uh-huh.
And so now you start to just kind of put yourself in the shoes of like an ancient Israelite farmer with a wife and some kids to feed. And now God's made this law that I can't sow crops this year. So I'm going to try to store away as much as I can during the first 6 years. But how am I going to make any money during the land Sabbath? And your only conclusion you come to is that you need to own livestock. And the fact that even during the first 6 years that you have to have at least part of your land and livestock ready to use for your livelihood during the land Sabbath is you're almost forced to do a crop rotation of animals and livestock, very similar to what we just explained from the Savory Institute, mm-hmm. and rejuvenate those soils. So that Brickett Wood Living Environment series kind of really brings out that point that God made this one very specific law, but that law basically like co-opts the full force and power of the free market to force farmers to do exactly what they need to do in order to keep the land fertile indefinitely.
Yeah, that's a great, great subject. And we've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller. He's written an article in the September edition of The Trumpet. The title of it is Yesterday's Farm, Today's Desert. And that's available on thetrumpet.com. You can go and look at the September edition and look at that that article. There's also an infographic in this issue that talks about the difference between God's law of agriculture versus those that are in use today. Really fascinating study. Thanks for looking into that and for sharing it with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
We've just introduced a new feature on thetrumpet.com. It's what I'm calling the magazine-style layout of articles versus the news-style layout that our readers are accustomed to seeing. But this new format, it gets rid of all the extraneous bits, the links to other articles and so on, and anything that would distract you from what you're there to do, and that is to read an in-depth article on thetrumpet.com. So I thought it would be good to share with our listeners some of the reasoning behind this, what we're trying to accomplish here. And to talk about this, we have our designer, Steve Herkus, and our online marketing manager, David Vigil. Hello, gentlemen.
Hi there.
Hello.
So we've got David on Skype. He's actually out of town this week. But so, David, I wanted to start with you. You are watching trends, how people are consuming information online. What are we trying to accomplish here? What's some of the reasoning behind some of the changes that we see on thetrumpet.com?
Well, online reading is a very difficult thing. You find that most people actually skim. So it's something that when it comes to reading, you want to do whatever you can to encourage that behavior. Skimming is just really easy with scrolling nowadays, and you always have the back button or the X button that is so easy for them to click if they lose interest. So what we want to do is encourage a nice reading experience so that they're more likely to stay and finish the article. What normally happens, how that translates into what actually happens is about every 300 to 500 words, you want to have some kind of graphic or call out, something to kind of snap their attention back to the article. And if you do that around every 300 to 500 words, it does promote people to stay on the site. It encourages them to keep reading. And by providing that nice experience and they see it, that there's a lot of care put into it, they're going to take it more seriously than, say, a 400 to 700 word article that's just pure text.
All right. Well, let's kick it over to Steve. Just from a design standpoint, what are some of the tools that you have at your disposal? How are you trying to kind of craft this experience online?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. One of the things that's just most important is the text itself, not only what it says, but how it appears. And having text in a font and laid out in a way that's very easy to read is so important. You don't want the layout of your text to be the first barrier that comes between someone reading the article or not. So you'll find on these feature articles that the text is a little bigger. It's spaced a little more nicely. There's a lot of objective reasons that go behind the way it is the way it is, so that people can enjoy that reading experience. And like David says, you're not going to have to go far before you're looking at a really beautiful, or not necessarily beautiful, but a really impactful picture or graphic that really arrests your attention and keeps your attention for a while and can sort of just give you a moment to breathe before you head back into the remainder of the long read. So, yeah, coupled between amazing pictures. One of the things about these trends is they are topics that we've looked at over a long period of time. So there's some really interesting history there. So we have a lot of photos to go back through and find the very best pictures that really help illustrate these articles in a sensational way. So coupled between the pictures, the maps, callouts, we really can use those in a powerful way to really dress up the articles.
So many of these, the articles that we're wanting to give this kind of special treatment to, these are the longer features. A lot of times, say, the articles that we have in our magazine, they might be 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 or more words. A lot of work has gone into them. And the way that we print it in the print edition of the magazine, there's a lot of effort that goes into the design and illustrating that article and maybe infographics that are associated with it and really making it an attractive experience in the magazine. To this point, we haven't had a whole lot of success at converting what's in the print edition into the online experience. There's always been, say, those bits on the side where you're looking at these other articles that you can go to or something that's drawing you away from this. And then there might be quite a bit of the design elements that end up getting lost when they're translated online. That's not the case anymore.
No, exactly. It's kind of funny when we're putting so much effort into dressing up an article that's worthy of that treatment in the magazine. It's like now that article is still worthy of that treatment in the online space as well. And the investment that we've made in time and energy and dressing up that article in the magazine is not lost now. We can transfer it over to the website. Plus, we're in the print edition, we're limited as far as space is concerned. We may have a glorious picture that's just really impactful, but it may only be 2 inches by 3 inches. Now it can fill your entire monitor, and we're not limited on page count when it comes to the website. So things can really breathe a lot more and make that long read online really enjoyable and manageable for you. Like David said, people are just so prone to scanning these days, but if they find something that really arrests their attention, then we can hold them a lot longer.
One thing that I'm excited about is just the maps, adding those in. I mean, you talk about the latitude that it gives us when we're not constrained by space, which so often is such a pressing issue when you're laying something out for the print edition. But a lot of these articles that you're laying out here, you're giving some really expansive and engaging maps that give you that geographical context, which is really nice.
Sometimes, too, those graphics and those really interesting maps are more valuable for that user than reading. They might actually bookmark to come back to use that map. They might be looking for a graphic to use. And so that's some information there that I think can be prized and that people will actively seek out. I know with, for example, in the old days of Stratfor, they had some really good maps about geography, and I would go back to that website just so I could pull that for a resource. So that is for a smaller audience, but it does have its own significance there. And then I think it's important too, just like in the magazine, how many pages you assign an article gives it weight and importance. This kind of treatment signals to somebody that this is going to take some time to read. We want you to digest this. It's a serious reading. And by signaling that, I think we'll lead them correctly. We don't want to mislead people so that they think, oh, it's just a short article that is want to scroll or skim. I think it's important to signal this is an important article. It's heavy, or it's very, it has deep analysis. Take your time, enjoy it.
You know, Steve mentioned the fact that some of these articles are actually going to be covering some of the broader trends that we are that we talk about often on the Trumpet. And we're introducing this new feature, this trends portion of the website, where we're able to link those shorter news articles. Sometimes it might be just a kind of an announcement of something that happened. Well, Iran launched this missile this week, but we're linking it to these in-depth trend articles that show these are the major trends in each of these geographical areas that we cover. Maybe you could talk about this a little bit here, David, and just what are we trying to accomplish with the trends portion?
Yeah, so the trends was our version of providing better context for people. When you look online, there are so many news sources, so many newspapers out there. You have social media presenting news as well. So anyone out there has access to a lot of information. Access to information is abundant. It's everywhere. One of the things that's important in that kind of environment then is to give information context. So for someone who's just looking at all the news, it can be difficult to put it in a bigger picture to give it contextual relevance as to why this is being reported on. And what trends allows us to do is put those smaller articles in. Sometimes we're reporting on events that no one else is reporting. They might seem a little obscure to some people. We might be reporting on a few comments by someone we're closely following. So for someone who's just coming in, you have to wonder, well, how are they going to find out why this is relevant? Why did we devote space to that, those few comments there? So what Trends allows us to do is to provide that context and do it in a way where we don't have to, say, kind of put it in those shorter articles where it can kind of slow down their reading, or if we have a lot of little updates in a trend. So say with North Korea, if there's a lot of significant steps that they take towards gaining nuclear weapons, instead of having maybe the same kind of paragraphs of information for four or five different articles, you can rely on the trends and kind of free up some of their time there. And for those who are specifically looking for why that's important, for specifically looking for more information, this is the way to do it. I know not everyone is going to look out for that information. That's obviously a smaller subset, but it's there. It provides the context, and we can answer some of the most important questions in, revolving around that specific event.
Yeah, I feel like you're hitting on something that this is a constant concern that we're bumping up against as we're putting our articles out there, as we're writing them. We're trying to engage the reader and make everything that we're doing as relevant and engaging as possible to the people that we're trying to reach, because there is so much noise out there. It's a very noisy environment. People have a lot of different things competing for their attention. Steve and I, we have discussions every month as we're putting the print edition together in how to engage the reader with these articles. How are we going to illustrate this and so on? Maybe you could just talk a little bit about your perspective as a designer looking at these articles and trying to kind of frame them and put them in their best light as you're presenting it to the reader.
Yeah, there's a number of goals that we're trying to achieve. Attracting people to the message is obviously important, so they pick it up in the first place, and then just getting their attention focused on the message. We live in a world, like we've all said, that's just full of noise, full of information, but the fact is people are focusing on something. They do know how to focus. It's just a case of what are they actually focusing on. And like David said earlier, these articles are dressed up in a way that shows people that this is important. You need to spend your time on them. When you think about it, you know, people scan and skim through web pages, you know, left, right, and center. Something like only 20% of content on your average web page is actually read. So much is being lost. But at the same time, millions of books are sold in this world, you know, I don't know, every day or every month. And people read those from cover to cover because the information is engaging, because they're invested in it. And so, you know, when we're illustrating these articles, we have that responsibility to show people that this is worth investing their time into it. It's worth being involved with it and sticking it through and reading it from one end to the other. So I think we'll see a, you know, bigger commitment out of readers to these, you know, dressed up articles than you normally would.
Well, we've been talking with the Trumpet's designer, thetrumpet.com designer, Steve Herkus, and our online marketing guru, manager, David V. Hill. Go check out their work at thetrumpet.com. There's a few articles up there now with the magazine-style layout, and we really hope that you enjoy it. Thanks, gents, for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
It's time for today's last word.
A lot of what passes for love is nothing of the sort. Few parents would say they don't love their children, but many don't really enjoy being around their children. Many give them money or things instead of personal time. Many give free access to a multitude of destructive influences. These things aren't love. Love must be the most misused, misunderstood word in our language. What is love, actually? The definition in the Bible is quite concrete and quite specific. Firstly, it says in 1 John 4 that God is love. Everything God does is love. His actions define love and help us to recognize what true love is. Of course, there are different and competing ideas of what God is. So let's look further. Another biblical definition of love is in 2 John 6, and this is love, that we walk after his commandments. So that's getting quite specific. Love isn't a hazy emotion. It is God's way of life. He outlined and provided details of that way of life in his commandments. By keeping them, not reluctantly, but with joyful obedience from the heart, we live that way of life and we prove through experience just what God's love is. 1 John 5 and verse 3 says, "For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not grievous." God's law represents and expresses his love. He gave it in order to spare us misery and heartache, to bring peace into our relationships and within our own minds. A lot of people use the term legalistic as an epithet. They say that law is oppressive, that authority is harsh. Well, the Bible says the opposite. It says that God's law is a great blessing. Scripture even tells us, carefully obey even the laws of the land that don't conflict with God's law. Why is that? It's because a law-abiding people is far happier and more peaceful than a lawless people. Just compare a school where students have free rein to a school where students respect teachers and administrators and obey the rules. One is a dead end. The other actually enables young people to learn and prepare for productive adulthood. We're all inspired by stories of an authoritative principal who transforms a lawless school into a lawful one, freeing children from squalor and giving them an opportunity to succeed in life. When we apply the law and we lay down rules for our children, we would do well to remember this. The purpose of the law is to help our children's joy. It's to facilitate their learning, to safeguard their happiness, to guarantee their safety and the safety of those around them. It's to teach them the submission to authority that's going to prepare them for an eternal loving relationship with God. The law is not a bludgeon, but a blessing. Measure your attitude and that of your children against this standard. The devil does his best to make us all resist and despise law and authority. We need not only to control our own thinking in order to love government and to see law for the blessing it is, but also to help our children do the same. Where those who deride this approach as legalistic go off track, as so many parents today do, is they fail to recognize God's judgment and God's correction as expressions of God's love. And that demonstrates total lack of understanding of the God of the Bible. The Apostle Paul wrote that, "Whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives." Jesus Christ himself says, "As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Be zealous, therefore, and repent." While he was in the flesh, he flipped over tables in order to drive mercenaries out of his father's house. He gave stern tongue lashings to unrepentant people. He rebuked and chastened. He demanded repentance, not because he hated people, but because he loved them. To the Pharisees, he unceremoniously called them hypocrites, serpents, vipers. He said, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you that kills the prophets and stoned them which are sent unto you, how often would I have gathered your children together, even as a hen gathers her chickens under her wings, and you would not? Behold, your house is left unto you desolate." Their severe punishment was necessitated by their rebellion against God's messengers, their rejection of God's love. If we understand the beautiful purpose of law, then the application of rebuke and chastening for disobedience makes perfect sense. God always aims it at redirecting our errant steps in order to guide us back onto the path of law-keeping that results in blessings. Sure, God gets angry, but he remains controlled. He never punishes beyond what is deserved. His anger is not contrary to his love. It's a product of his love. Truly, God is always eager to extend mercy and forgiveness to someone who repents, who's willing to turn from sin. God loves everyone unconditionally. He holds out hope for the repentance of every sinner. That is the truth of the Bible, both in the New Testament and in the Old. We should always try to emulate God's example as parents. If we find ourselves getting frustrated, out of control, angry, vindictive, worn out with our children, we need to stop. We need to humble ourselves. Pray for help to ensure that our actions are nothing less than expressions of unconditional love for our children. There shouldn't be any doubt in our children's minds that we love them unconditionally. Our aim is to be just in our judgment, measured in our discipline, generous with our instruction and teaching, and big-hearted in giving our children blessings when they obey. That is exactly how God parents. The better we do those things, the greater the likelihood that our children will grow up recognizing and sincerely appreciating the unbreakable connections between law, government, love, and God.
I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much to my guests on the program today, Richard Palmer, Andrew Miller, Steve Herkus, and David Vigil. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Plato. Wise men talk because they have something to say. Fools, because they have to say something. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.